Well, we're continuing our study of systematic theology this morning. This is actually part 9. And thus far, we've been talking about the doctrine of God, theology proper. And this morning, I want to discuss a few more of God's perfections that lend themselves to a briefer treatment than those we've covered thus far. Don't get me wrong, we could literally spend months talking about the perfections that we are going to address this morning, but that's really not our purpose. We're really committed to whetting your appetites for further study of these things and not creating a situation where we're going through these things in a great deal of depth. I wouldn't say it's a 35,000 foot view, but it is a little lower than that. You could literally make a lifetime of studying just theology proper. And again, we're not going to hit everything. People have come up to me after each of these lessons and they say, well, when are you going to talk about this? When are you going to talk about that? Well, there's a good chance whatever you're thinking I might not ever talk about. But again, these lessons are just intended to whet your appetite, get you to studying more of these things on your own. Now, this morning, the perfections I want to cover are God's simplicity, His eternity, His immensity, and His sovereignty. Those speakers out there seem to be really loud because I can hear myself. It sounds like I'm speaking in a great coliseum somewhere.
Simplicity of what?
Huh?
Simplicity of what?
Simplicity, eternity, immensity, and sovereignty. Now, I'm kind of sketchy on the sovereignty thing. If you think I'm going to attach that to the last part of a series like this, that's probably not going to happen. I might touch upon it. It depends on how far we actually get with these other things. Now, remember, thus far we've been looking at what we call God's incommunicable perfections. That is, those perfections that are uniquely and particularly His and His alone. And those are things which cannot be shared with His creatures. Next Lord's Day, Lord willing, we'll begin to look at some of God's communicable attributes, or the things that characterize us as His image bearers. Anyway, first things first, let's look at God's simplicity. Now, I realize there are some here who might recoil slightly at the suggestion that God is a simple being. And that's because, generally speaking, whenever we use the word simple today, it refers to that which is less, that which is easy, that which lacks sophistication, or that which lacks the complexity which would render it something to be preferred or something to be admired. Thankfully, that's not what the doctrine of God's simplicity conveys. The doctrine of God's simplicity was once a very well understood, very popular doctrine among Christians. And today it's probably one of the least understood, probably one of the least discussed of God's perfections. Why? Well, I believe it's because over the last few centuries, there has been an undercurrent or a push in the church at large, whether that's intentional, whether it's subliminal, I think it's probably a little bit of both. But there's been this push to relegate God to a position of being more and more like us. You can see this. This is really the byproduct of secular humanism invading and encroaching upon even the church. This is really the byproduct of our lofty esteem for ourselves. This is really something that should be expected, given that we have really lost any sense of who God is in the church at large, on a wide variety of levels. So, God, in the Scriptures, vehemently denies that He's like us. Psalm 50, verse 21. You'll recall there He chastises rebellious Israel, saying, "You thought I was just like you. I will reprove you and state the case in order before your eyes." Job got a little of this same treatment in Job chapter 38 and following. Anytime anyone in the Scriptures gets the idea that they know who God is, that God is like them, that they can bring God down to their level, God instantly corrects them. And the problem again today is very few people actually read their Bibles. Very few people are actually familiar with the God of Scripture. Instead, they have a God of their own making, a God who is really, as I said last time, a cosmic bellhop at their beck and call, a God who's there to solve their problems but not to interfere otherwise in their lives. And again, this has had a devastating effect on what we know about God, even from the study of His Word. This continued expansion of this idea that God is just like you and me is actually responsible for a great number of erroneous teachings that continue to plague the church today. How so? Well, I would argue that the entire system of Arminian theology is based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the doctrine of God. And if you know anything at all about Arminian theology, that's free will theology, that's man-centered theology, then you know that to be true. For example, according to Arminian doctrine, it is entirely unfair for God to act sovereignly and independently from His creatures. The Arminian insists that God responds to man, that God is obligated to respond to man, especially as it regards salvation. The Arminian insists that in order to be saved, we must give God permission to save us. We must allow God to save us. There must be a cooperative agreement between God, who is able to save, and man, who has to permit him to do so. And this is why in classic Arminianism, man's also able to lose his salvation. I mean, it only stands to reason, if you're able to secure your salvation, if God is simply someone who responds to your allowing him to save you, then you can also at some point abandon the whole idea of being saved, right? At some point you can just throw it all away because you secured it for yourself. Why can't you just as easily give it up at some point? And this is what makes the doctrine of limited atonement such an abomination to the Arminian as well, to suggest that Christ died to make certain the salvation of His people, as opposed to dying to make possible the salvation of anyone and everyone who chooses to give Him permission to save them. That's unacceptable. The Arminian does not like the idea that God and God alone saves for no other reason than He is sovereignly inclined to do so. They just don't like that idea. And you can understand why. If your theology is man-centered, anything that encroaches upon what you feel is somehow reserved exclusively for you, anytime that's threatened, that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing. And we're going to talk about this in the next hour. So put a mental bookmark there and let's move on. A misunderstanding of God's simplicity is also responsible for the debate. And unless you're a theological egghead, unless you're a theological nerd like myself, you're probably unaware that there's even a debate raging now. But there's a debate raging in some circles, in Reformed circles, concerning the impassibility of God, right? What do we mean by impassibility? What we mean is, according to chapter 2 of the Westminster Confession of Faith, God is impassible. God is without parts or passions. And what do we mean when we say that God is without passions? Well, what we mean by that is that God does not have emotions that are subject to change when His circumstances change. There are many who argue that God must have emotions. Why? Because we have emotions. You see, a lot of people reverse engineer God. They look at themselves first, and then they say, well, God must be like us because we're made in His image. That's not the way to approach being the imago Dei, the image bearers of God. The correct way to approach being the image bearers of God is to look at God first, and then see which of those attributes, those perfections, are communicated to us as human beings. It's not proper to do the other thing, right? But there are people who say, well, God must have emotions because we have emotions and we're created in His image. But that's not correct, because as we discussed when we looked at the immutability of God, It's literally impossible for God to change. And that means that it's impossible for God to change from happy to sad. You understand that, right? It's impossible for God to go from being happy to sad, from mad to glad, or undergo any type of emotional change. Why? Because he's impervious to any change. This misunderstanding of God's simplicity is also responsible for the way many think about their eternal state. You've heard this a million times if you've heard it once. You know, why does God send good people to hell just because they won't believe? And what's that predicated on? Yeah, it's predicated on the idea that there are good people in the world. And Paul tells us in Romans chapter 3, verses 10 and following, there are no good people in the world. That, again, is the superimposition of how we define goodness, and we place our definition of goodness in the mind of God. God must see goodness the way we see goodness. God must define goodness the way we define goodness. But it's not true. God defines goodness as perfection. And there is only one who is good in the mind of God, and that is himself, as manifested in the incarnate Christ, also God of very God. But still, that doesn't stop many people from saying, well, you know, God is unfair in sending good people to hell when they deserve a break. Who deserves a break? Nobody. I've said it before, I'll say it again. What's really unfair is that God saves anyone. Not that he doesn't save everyone, but that he saves anyone. I had someone tell me once that he was convinced that he would be able to talk his way out of hell on the day of judgment because he was always able to convince his parents that he was worthy of their grace and mercy. And after all, God is the best father, isn't he? He's like, well, God's just my father. And I was able to convince my earthly father and mother that I was worthy of their grace, worthy of their mercy. I was always able to talk myself out of sticky situations. So when I stand before God on that day, I'll be able to make my case and he'll let me off the hook. You see what he's done there? He's superimposed his own experience with earthly, fallible human parents. He's taken that idea of parenthood, of fatherhood, and placed it onto God. Now, I understand how comforting it is to make God as much like ourselves as possible. You know, it helps us to relate more readily to him, and I think it often serves as a balm for our guilty consciences when we consider him to be pliable, when we actually consider God to be able to be manipulated. But here's the thing. His divine simplicity doesn't allow for those types of conclusions. Why? Let me explain. The doctrine of divine simplicity comes from the classic theological understanding that I mentioned just a minute ago from the second chapter of the Westminster Confession of Faith, and that is that God is without parts or passions. Let me read to you the whole of that statement, and this will probably make more sense. The confession says, there is but one only living and true God, who is infinite in being and perfection, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions, immutable, immense, eternal, incomprehensible, almighty, most wise, most holy, most free, most absolute, working all things according to the counsel of his own immutable and most righteous will, for his own glory, most loving, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, the rewarder of them that diligently seek him, and withal most just and terrible in his judgments, hating all sin, and who will by no means clear the guilty. I mean, that's a really large statement, and buried within that statement is this statement that God is without parts or passions. What do we mean when we say that God is without parts or passions? Well, we just covered the passions part of that. He's not affected by circumstances. He's not affected by things that change him in any way. He doesn't have mood swings. We do. But it's wholly inappropriate and improper to attach those things to God himself. So what do we mean when we say that God is without parts or passions? Well, we mean that God simply is. He simply is. Now follow me here, because this is really important. One of the most fundamental things for the believer to grasp is what is known as the creator-creation distinction. The creator-creature distinction. In other words, there is a vast difference between the creator and what he has created. It's really an unsearchable difference. It's really an incomprehensible difference between God and that which he has created, especially when it concerns us. In the created realm, as I said a minute ago, the more complex something is, the more worth we ascribe to it. Isn't that true? The more intricate something is, the more worth we ascribe to it. If you've ever looked inside a pocket watch, anybody ever done that? Or like a grandfather clock, or something with all those little wheels and all of those gears, all of those cogs and springs and weights, and somebody figured out how to put all of those things together to where that thing would tell you what time it is. Clock making is an ancient trade. I still don't understand how all that works. I just don't. And you've probably looked at those things and you've probably marveled at the genius required to get all of those things to work in such a way as to keep accurate time. As Christians, we often marvel at the complexity of the human body. Those of you who are homeschooling and you teach your children biology, those of you who have taken biology and you've just investigated something as simple as the cell, how complex we are. And what happens in that complexity when one of those little pieces, one of those constituent parts breaks down and stops working? There's a domino effect, right? There's a ripple effect. And before long, nothing works. You know, the second law of thermodynamics, entropy, which says that things go from a state of order to a state of chaos. Everyone in this room is a victim of entropy. You are being microwaved to death by the sun's rays. And in the process, you are aging. And as you age, things start breaking down. And if you don't believe me, wait till you're 60. Things that I could do long ago, I can no longer do. I just can't. Why? Because certain things are just breaking down. Aging is proof that the complex begins to break down because there are so many parts that depend on each other. The more complex something is, the more each of its parts depend on the other parts. We're far more impressed by those things than we are, let's say, a simple rock. I mean, you look at a rock on the ground, you might have some geological nerds who say, well, no, that's igneous rock, or that's sedimentary rock, or that's, you know, whatever. It's a rock. It doesn't do anything. I mean, unless you're David and you're facing Goliath, and you need five of them, right? But even then, it requires human intervention to make them do anything. You leave a rock on the ground, it's going to stay on the ground. It's going to stay there. It does nothing of real value. You get the idea. What we don't realize, however, and I alluded to this just a minute ago, is that the more complex something is, the more dependent it is. I mean, anything that's complex is dependent. And the more complex something gets, the more dependent it becomes on other things to keep it going. Listen to James Dolezal here, because he's really helpful on this. He says, and follow along, he's kind of a hard read sometimes. I think this will be fairly straightforward. But he says, classical Christian orthodoxy contends that the first cause of all being, which is God, right? must be simple for the straightforward reason that complex or compound things depend on parts that are more fundamental in being than themselves. And nothing is more primary in being than God. Now listen to this. Parts are really so many causes giving some form of actuality to those entities in which they are integrated and enabling them to operate as they do, like the 6 million parts of a Boeing 747. Composite beings are doubly dependent, first upon their various component parts, and second upon whatever agent or power acts to unify their parts in them. Now, let that soak in for just a minute. Things with a lot of parts, things with complexity, automatically create dependencies upon one another. You take that one little spring out of your watch, what happens? It's done. You take one little cog out of the watch, what happens? It's done. Let one of the teeth break off of one of those cogs, what happens? Your watch is slow or fast or whatever the case might be. It stops functioning as it's designed to function. This is what Dolezal is saying. The more complex something is, the more dependent it is on its individual parts. But if this were how God had his being, then he could not be the absolute creator and source of all things. There would be causes of God's own being more primitive and foundational than himself. The Puritan Stephen Charnock distills this basic claim. God is the most simple being, for that which is first in nature, having nothing beyond it, cannot by any means be thought of to be compounded, for whatsoever is so depends upon the parts whereof it is compounded, and so is not the first being. Now God, being infinitely simple, hath nothing in himself which is not himself, and therefore cannot will in any change in himself, his being his own essence and existence. Now let me break this down for you, because I can already hear the groans. People are reaching for their aspirin in their purse. Look, God is simple because if God himself were made up of parts, then that would necessitate that those parts that make him up would predate him. The parts that make God up would have to have been made by something or someone else and then combined in such a way as to produce God. That can't be. Why? Because God is the first cause. God is the primary being of all. This is why when Moses on Mount Sinai was asking God, who shall I say is sending me? When I go down and tell these people God has said, who shall I say wrote these things? Who shall I say I'm being a messenger for? And what did God say? Tell them I am. That's odd. That's odd. But bound up in that statement, I am, we find completion, perfection, and simplicity. Simplicity. Now again, we're not suggesting God is a simpleton. In other words, there's no negativity implied by the doctrine of divine simplicity. We're simply saying what God says of himself in his great I am statements. And this helps us understand that when God says that he is love, he's not saying that he loves, which is true. That's an outworking of who he is. But he's not saying that. He's saying he is love. He is love. When we say that God is justice, we're not saying that he exercises justice. We're saying that he is the embodiment of justice. When we say that he is holy and thrice holy, we're not saying that he behaves in a holy manner. We're saying that he's the embodiment of holiness. He is those things. In other words, his perfections are not individual components that make him who he is. They're all bound up in him as demonstrations of his being. They're not parts. They're simply who he is. And this is why there's no change in those things. Have you ever thought about that? Some of you have probably never thought about the simplicity of God. But here's one of the reasons it's so important. When we think of God as just being, I am, He is, then we understand His immutability on the standpoint that the things that make Him who He is are inviolable, unchangeable things. We might pick them apart in systematic theology and talk about one thing or the other as far as His perfections go. But in the process, we're not doing anything to Him by removing anything from Him, nor are we adding anything to Him, which is why I prefer the word perfections as opposed to attributes. We're not attributing anything to God when we recognize who He is. And this prevents us from thinking of God in terms of, well, you know, he loves and then He hates. The same person. Not true. We've talked about that, right? Now, from our perspective, yes, and I've clarified that, I hope, to your satisfaction. From our human perspective, yes, we were at one time the objects of God's wrath, as far as we knew. But then when we realized that we were loved from before the foundation of the world, we learned that we were never really the objects of His wrath. That in eternity past, He called us out to be numbered among His elect. And as such, there was never a moment where we were really, in His mind, the objects of wrath. You see, so we break, to help us understand things, we do break God down into His constituent parts. But they're not really constituent parts. He is. This is who He is. Now, if your head's still hurting at this point, that's okay. Because what we're asking ourselves to do when we contemplate things like the simplicity of God is to remove ourselves from the very realm in which we exist. Everything in our world is made up of parts. That's all we know. Right? So to wrap our brain around the fact that God is not really made up of parts, but is one essential primary being in His totality, which therefore renders Him immutable, it all starts to make sense. The reason He can't change is because there's nothing in Him to change. You see where simplicity becomes really important? Stop making God like yourself. Because a God like yourself can change. A God like yourself does change. But one who is, always has been and always will be, can never change. We, not God, are complex creatures. God simply is. And I think that's a distinction that renders Him and Him alone worthy of our awe, worthy of wonder, praise, and adoration. I would even go so far as to say that the remaining perfections that I want to talk about this morning are all predicated on God's simplicity. They must be. Everything about God is predicated on His simplicity. The first of these is His eternity. Now, as we go through these things, you're going to start to realize, wait a minute, if I look at these things in the light of His simplicity, they become much more meaningful. They become much more understandable. When we say that God is an eternal being, what do we mean? Earlier in our study, we talked about the aseity of God. Remember that? God's self-existence and His self-sufficiency. So there again, His self-existence and His self-sufficiency speak to His simplicity. Because only something that is self-contained, with no moving parts to break, no constituent parts to wither away or be changed in any way, only such a thing can come about due to self-existence and self-sufficiency. One of the things that's covered under this particular doctrine And you'll hearken back to when we studied the aseity of God. But one of the things that we talked about was the fact that God has always existed. And that's important. When we talk about God's eternity, the primary reason that's important is because if not, God could very well be called a complex being because somebody or some force would have been responsible for beginning him. Right? If God has a beginning, then one has to ask, where did that beginning come from? Who created him? Who caused him to be? What caused him to be? And if there's anything you can put in that blank, then God can't be God because he's not self-existent. By the way, what would we call that primary cause that created God? God. Then that thing becomes God. Well, where did that thing come from? At some point, you have to go with the self-existence. This is what really stumps all these scientists who claim that they understand the origin of things, right? I've told you before, you can take them all the way back. You know, even before their alleged Big Bang happened, you can take them all the way back to that one primordial particle the size of a BB in which everything in the known universe was housed. Like you believe that, but you don't believe in God? You believe that everything in the universe, all energy, all matter, all everything was crammed into a space the size of a BB, and then it reached critical mass and boom, it all exploded and it's been moving outward ever since? Really? And you call me a simpleton? But you can take somebody all the way back. The one question they can never answer. Where'd the BB come from? They can't answer it. Some scientists have even been so bold as to say, well, it just always was. No. You violated the primary principle of scientific inquiry. The primary principle of scientific inquiry is that you look at the empirical data and you make conclusions on that data, and part of that process includes the idea that there are no uncaused effects. Scientists will tell you, there's nothing that exists that was uncaused. Until you drag them all the way back to the very beginning, and they say, well, no, it just must have always been. No. I tell you who has always been. God has always been. Much simpler. Even the doctrine of God is much simpler than all of the manufactured pseudoscience that tells us things that we cannot verify in the slightest. Children, evolution is a theory. And evolution is a shoddy theory at best. If you're going to public school, don't fall hook, line, and sinker for the lies that they're going to tell you about human origins. Man was created in the image of God. Amen. That's right. By a God who has always existed. Right. Don't be fooled. Amen. You'll be seen as a simpleton. You'll be ridiculed as someone who just doesn't get it. You'll be seen as someone whose mind is not as nuanced or complex as the true student's mind. Don't fall for that. It's a theory. Not unlike the theory of climate change that we call weather. That it's astounding that they're just now figuring out that there's weather on the earth. Well, where do we go to Scripture to find out that God is eternal? Well, Psalm 90. Psalm 90 is a good place to start in verse 2. It's actually a recording of the prayer of Moses. In Psalm 90, verse 2, we read this. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. What's everlasting mean? Everlasting. Always. What's always mean? Forever. Forever in what direction? In all directions. When we're told from everlasting to everlasting, we're told to consider, go backwards into infinity, and then go forwards into infinity. Now you have everlasting to everlasting. How far backwards is infinity? Infinitely backwards. As a matter of fact, you can't even use the word far. Far denotes distance. Infinity is not a distance. Infinity is infinity. And again, I'm challenging you to get outside of your space and time mind. We're all space-time creatures. We only understand things relative to space and time, right? I'm asking you to get out of that mindset and think for a minute about what infinity really means.
Air.
What'd you say?
Air.
Air. I know what you mean by that. Yeah, I mean, go back as far as you can, go forward as far as... What, see, that even breaks down. But God is from everlasting to everlasting. Another good reference would be Psalm 102. Psalm 102, verses 25 through 27. There we read, "Of old you founded the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Even they will perish, but you endure. And all of them will wear out like a garment, like clothing. You will change them, and they will be changed. But you are the same, and your years will not come to an end." Our God is an eternal God. And that means that all of His perfections are eternal. And you see, the thing is, if all of His perfections are eternal, that must mean that the love that He has for you now, that He has always had for you as one of His children, is predicated on His eternity. Well, next we come to His immensity. Immensity. We talk about God's eternity, and that places Him outside of the confines of time. His immensity places Him beyond the confines of space. And I've mentioned a few times now how many of our problems and many of the misunderstandings we have about God are caused by the fact that our God is simply not big enough. We've talked about that, I think, every week during this systematic theology study. Our problem is our God is not big enough because we've put Him in a box of our own making. We've made Him like us. We've attached to Him all things that are like us. And so, you know, in our minds, God is just not, He's big enough for us, but He's really not the God of all creation. He's the God of our own satisfaction. We've fallen for the lie that I spoke about a moment ago, in which we brought God down to our level in an effort to make Him more like us. And in the process, we've lost the sense of His immensity. So what do we mean when we refer to God's immensity? Well, simply put, what we mean is God is big. God is really big. How big? Infinitely big. And what does that do to the word big? It strips us of our ability to even use the word big. Why? Because what does size refer to? Size refers to the amount of space that something occupies. How much space does God occupy? All of it. Well, how much is that? It's infinite. So get this. The correct way of saying that, when we talk about God's eternity and God's immensity, the best way to say it is that God transcends space and time. He's outside of it completely. He is other than the space and time. You realize space and time are divine condescensions to us. Space and time are probably the greatest helps we have as human beings. Every bit of your life is lived in accordance with the space-time continuum in which you live. How do you know when to be somewhere? Time. How do you know where to be? Space. How do you know the distance that you'll travel in time to get from where you are to where you need to be? Space and time. So everything you do is predicated on space and time. How many years on earth do you have left? That's a consideration of time. How long have you lived? We celebrate birthdays every year. That's a measure of time. See how that works? So we take it for granted. But we need to realize that God Himself is not bound in any way by space or time. How does that work? Don't know. Because I'm bound to space and time. This means that space and time are meaningless when we consider God's existence. It means that given God's complete omnipresence, remember what we talked about when we talked about omnipresence? There is nowhere in any realm, whether in the temporal realm in which we live or the expanse of the heavenly realm, which is infinite, there is nowhere that God is not. I mentioned Solomon's prayer when he dedicated his temple. 1 Kings 8, 26 and 27. Solomon understood this. He says, "And now, O God of Israel, let your word that you promised your servant David, my father, come true. But will God really dwell on earth?" In other words, Solomon looks at this grandiose temple that he has made for God, and he says, "It's foolish of me to think that you would live here." Why? He says, "The heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain you. How much less this temple I have built." Solomon understood that God could not be contained in any regard, much less in the temple that he had built for him. And the question for all of us, when we think that our problems are big, when we are forced to acknowledge that our faith is so small, the question for all of us should be, how big is my God? Because if you have a God who's immense, if you have a God who's eternal, nothing that will happen to you in the here and now, that is, nothing that will ever happen to you in time and space, is really of any consequence when it comes to the view of eternity. In the view of eternity, if you live to be 100 years, that's not even a blip on the screen. God's immensity should really be one of our greatest comforts. And again, it stems from His eternity, which stems from His simplicity. We simply have to remember that He is so, right? We simply have to remember that God is bigger than our problems. And yet, we don't worship a God who is afar off, do we? He's right here. So what about the last of these perfections? God's sovereignty. I'm not going to even define that. Come back next Lord's Day. I think we'll spend the whole Sunday school hour talking about what I believe is probably the most pivotal doctrine as it regards us as humans. If we can grasp the sovereignty of God and understand it, that you see, everybody will agree that God's sovereign. Even the card-carrying, staunchest Arminian out there will tell you, yes, God is sovereign. But they don't really understand what sovereignty is. Because if God is truly sovereign, then they're not free. Not in the sense they think themselves to be free. And we'll explore that more in our time together next time.